So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the first seminar in reconsidering, of this term at least, of reconsidering early Jewish nationalist ideologies. I'm Peter Bergerman, and we're running this seminar kind of in even numbered weeks in conjunction with the Israel Studies seminar, which is a little bit different than last term, but I think it's a good way to go. Thank you very, very much for coming. A couple of things before I introduce the speaker. At the end, obviously, there will be a Q&A session. For those of you who have questions, if you click on the Q&A chat function, you'll be able to post a question. Your name obviously will also come up with this. And since this event is being recorded and will be streamed at some stage, if you don't want to be identified kind of for posterity in when we eventually send this out, please just indicate that in your question, and I won't say a name. Otherwise, I'd like to introduce my speaker, and with great pleasure, in fact, Yair Wallach, who's God, I've got to somehow turn down my email notifications at the same time. Too much technology at once. Yair is I've known for quite a long time, and in fact since he took the job at SOAS, and it's therefore a real pleasure to introduce him today. Yair is the senior lecturer in Israeli studies at SOAS, the University of London, where he is also the head of the SOAS Center for Jewish Studies. He is a cultural and social historian of modern Palestine Israel, who has published articles in Hebrew, Arabic and English on urban and visual culture and on Jewish Arab relations. His book, A City in Fragments, which I'm very glad to inform you about today, which was published by Stanford University Press in 2020, looks at Arabic and Hebrew street texts, such as inscriptions, banners, graffiti, and other media in modern Jerusalem. Dr. Wallach Yair is currently, until 2022, I believe, a Leverhulme Research Fellow, and his project called the Arab Ashkenazi looks at Jewish Ashkenazi acculturation in the Arab Levant. Wallach has also published articles in Haaretz, The Guardian, and other media. And today he's going to speak to you on the language of revival or conquest, Hebrew in the streets of early 20th century Jerusalem. So Yair.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter, and thank you, Yaakov, and thank you both for this invitation and for the generous introduction. This talk will be based on my book, which Peter has shown, and I'll show you again. It's called A City in Fragments, Urban Text in Modern Jerusalem. And the idea of the book is to look at textuality in urban sphere, forms of text that are part of the environment or part of social life, in the sense that not books or newspapers so much, but the kind of inscriptions, graffiti, street name plates, various textual artifacts like money, like ID cards, like visiting cards, the kind of text that people read in part of their everyday life and today not think so much about. And the idea is to look at how reading and writing changed in Arabic and Hebrew between the middle of the 19th century and up until the mid 20th century. That's the idea. I'll talk today about Hebrew, but it's important to say that I look at both languages and there's a lot of parallel developments in both languages, and there are also, of course, developments that pit the two languages against each other, and I'll talk about it a bit in this talk. So before I come to talk about Hebrew and to talk about Hebrew texts, I should say something about the social landscape that we're talking about. And what do we mean when we say Jews in Jerusalem, the late Ottoman period and the mandatory period? And here I'm talking basically against various narratives or various historical understandings that I think some of the viewers would be familiar with more or less. But I'll primarily say how I see it first. So in the early 19th century, early and mid 19th century. There's the number of Jews in Jerusalem about, say, 2,000 in the middle of the century, and the number, the population of the city generally is relatively small. From the middle of the 19th century until 1900, the city grows dramatically. So on the eve of the First World War, we're talking about something between 60 to 80,000 people. It depends who you count and who is counting. So we have estimates. But the city really grows dramatically. And Jews, Jewish communities in the city grow dramatically to tens of thousands. Now, what is important for me to say is that it's a very confusing and landscape, because in some ways we are talking about separate or distinct Jewish communities, and I think this is very important to say. We are talking about a large Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazi communities. Again, within them there's lots of divisions. Then there's Sephardic Jews, which have a longer history in the Ottoman Empire, and there's more recent migrants like Yemenite Jews, Bukharan Jews, Maghrebi Jews, Georgian Jews, and Jews from Baghdadi Jews, and so forth. So we have dramatic growth, and most of it coming from emigration into the city. So the number of communities that can kind of trace themselves backwards is to before the 19th century is limited. So on the one hand, these are separate communities in terms of their social life, who leads them, which schools they send their kids to, where do they, which yeshiva they go to, where do they pray, where they're buried, and so forth. We're talking about separate social organizations in many ways. But in other ways, these communities are seen as part of a bigger whole and occasionally would act as part or as a kind of coordinated network. Okay, so that's part of the dynamic that I'm going to talk about. And that becomes more pronounced the more when we move to the 20th century, when these communities are more and more inclined to consider thinking of themselves as part of a single community. And that assumes proto-national Jewish dimensions, it assumes Zionist dimensions, but it only becomes a social reality in the 20s and 30s, in my view, and in the sense that by the 30s, most Jews go to similar schools, they speak the same language, they have more or less one leadership, which is, of course, has various factions, but one recognized leadership. So that kind of congeals into something that we can call society, a Jewish society in Palestine, which does not exist in 1880 or 1890 and so forth. Okay, so I think that's important. Now, one arena in which this is happening is through Hebrew, because Hebrew, as a language that is in common use of all these Jewish communities, provides some kind of imagined landscapes which is shared. It's shared in 1850, it's shared in 1900, it's shared in 1930, but the meaning of that shared community or imagined community changes throughout this period. And I think that's what we'll see here. So let me start by, okay, so I'll mainly show various examples of what Hebrew means to whom and what does it imply. So let me, so I hope you can see this. Yep. You can see this? Okay, so So I think one of the most striking forms of textuality in the urban space of Jerusalem is dedication inscriptions. And again, if we go back to the 1830s, there's only one recognized synagogue in Jerusalem. It's four separate Sephardic synagogues that are connected as kind of part of one complex. And we have a Karaite synagogue, and we have maybe one or two unrecognized Ashkenazi synagogues, but that's it. So that means that there's very few visible Jewish institutions, and by implication, there's also very few places where you could expect to see Hebrew in the urban sphere. By the time we reach 1900, there are dozens and well over 100 of Jewish institutions in both inside the walls and outside the walls. And we see a dramatic explosion of these kind of dedication inscriptions. The most striking form of textuality in these congregational institutions, which included synagogues, seminaries, almshouses, various other kind of congregational institutions, were these kind of dedication inscriptions that you can see here, that are usually long paragraphs of texts, which usually talk about the they have the name of the donor and the family, and the terms of the donation, usually warning against selling the property, and saying that this is for to be, in this case, a synagogue or a seminary, a bet midrash, and so forth. Okay, this is an example of one such dedication inscriptions in the Bukharan quarter, outside the city walls. I would say a few things on these kind of inscriptions, that this is not a sign. This is not something that you kind of pass in the street and read casually. This is a paragraph of text that you have to stand in front of it and kind of read it carefully if you want to read it. And we can assume that normally people didn't do it, you know, on a daily basis. It's not that the name of the institution is highlighted in any, sometimes the name is not even mentioned, the name of the donor is mentioned. Okay, so this is not unlike if we go to, you know, institution today, we would usually expect a big sign above the entrance saying the name of the synagogue and so forth. This is not the kind of text. This is a text that is about a form of writing that inscribes the conditions and the meaning into the fabric of the institution. And it's a, basically we can look at it as a kind of act of worship that kind of is written into these institutions which are about congregational life and worship in themselves. Now, one of the ways to know about these inscriptions is from a survey that was conducted in 1928 by a person called Pinchas Ben Tzvi Gruyevsky, and you can see this on the left of the dedication stone. And it's a series of booklets that he published on the name Stones of Memory of Nezi Karon, in which he collected all the, wrote down all these dedication inscriptions and documented them, including some other places beyond Jerusalem, but mainly focusing on Jerusalem. What is interesting about this is that, first of all, it's an amazing corpus of evidence. And Gruyevsky says that he's propelled by he feels like these have to be documented because some of them are very old and they're falling to pieces, and this is a very important information and so forth. But when you look at the corpus of inscriptions, it is striking how these are really modern inscriptions, in the sense that I think there's 10 inscriptions before 1850 out of 2000. And 2/3 of these inscriptions were placed between 1900 and 1914. So that kind of shows you how this kind of explosion of Jewish life in Jerusalem happens in this very particular moment, and it does not rest on existing communities, but it's actually a very recent thing. Now, Gruevski has various reasons why he justifies his project. Why is it so important to document these inscriptions? But it's very clear that he feels that in 1928, he is someone who was born in Jerusalem to a family that came from Belarus, Ashkenazi, Litvak, that kind of received traditional education and did not, I don't think he ever traveled beyond Palestine. He understands that his community is being written out of the historical record as the quote-unquote old yeshuv, traditional, reactionary, unimportant, and portrayed in various negative terms by the new Zionist hegemony. And he's very keen to write his communities into the historical narrative. And he fails in the sense that this amazing corpus of evidence has not been used by any historian of Jerusalem. I mean, the only exception is Reuven Gafni, who wrote something very brief on it. And I think it's quite striking because it's quite an interesting body of evidence for social history of Jerusalem. Now, coming back to the inscription, what is interesting about these inscriptions are various things. The first thing is that they usually describe donations from overseas. So they basically portray the kind of political economies of charity in which different communities were embedded. So we can see that Jerusalem was in the center of various networks of charity and so forth. And that was determined usually by ethnic logic. And we can see very clear that generally Bukharan institutions were supported by Bukharan donors and Maghrebi by donors from North Africa, Ashkenazim, depending where they were. But these are all separate kind of networks of charity that highlight the fact that these are in many ways different communities. There are some examples of cross charity, and we have Baghdadi donors that donate to the Chabad synagogue and to the Churva synagogue and so forth. So we do have a cross ethnic charity and support, but these are the exception rather than the rule. So on the one hand, when you look at these kind of inscriptions, it's usually very easy to tell which congregation are we talking about. On the other hand, by using similar language, like the quote from Isaiah at the top of the inscription, and by using Hebrew square letters, that kind of these inscriptions were legible to a wider constituency, wider, so Jews from other communities. So we can say that if there is a sense of common denominator through Hebrew, it establishes a kind of maybe sense of peoplehood, a kind of sense of solidarity between different communities that often function separately and differently, but do have a lot of common at the same time and understand each other as Jewish communities. Okay, so this is one example of Hebrew and one of the most striking examples of Hebrew, which is as a congregational language not a national language, and certainly not a language that lays claim to the land, to the geography, to the territory. You know, it does not seek to connect with some ancient past and to reclaim the kind of Zionist claims that we'll see later are completely absent in these kinds of very, very visible inscriptions. Another example of inscriptions that we would see in Jerusalem and the spirit is graffiti of pilgrims in various holy sites, in various holy tombs, and dramatically, I would say, on the Western Wall, and this is one of the chapters of my book, that idea that the Western Wall is one of the places you would see Hebrew in large square letters, but the very presence is predicated on the idea that Hebrew is not written everywhere. It's a language laden with sanctity, particularly in the square letters, and its use in public space is about a congregational act and an act of worship and veneration. I'm not going to go into detail about the graffiti because it's a long story. Now, so this is one form of very dominant form of Hebrew that one exists. At the same time, we have the more the Jewish communities grow, we have other forms that are different, that are what we, if we look at the dedication inscription, this is a format that goes back centuries and so forth. But we have also much more recent forms of textuality that are interesting in the kind of claims they make about Hebrew. First is Hebrew is a commercial language that has a commercial value as a common denominator between different Jewish communities. Okay, so on the one hand, we have communities that do not speak each other's languages in many ways, but they do read Hebrew, at least the literate among the communities. And that means that if you want to advertise, for example, something, you can advertise in Hebrew, and you will reach Sephardic and Maghrebi and Ashkenazi people all at the same time. Or if you can see here, this is the use of the Hebrew for postcards. The story of this postcard is the Ottoman post office decides to open a branch in Street of the Jews in Jerusalem, and it hires a guy called Eliyahu Hanig, a Hasidic Jew, who calls himself in Arabic Elias Effendi. And he is a very entrepreneurial character who is involved in many, many initiatives. And he opens this branch, and in order to attract business, he issues these postcards which say, in French and in Hebrew, the post of the Turkish government in the Street of the Jews in the city and the holy city of Jerusalem may be rebuilt soon. Okay, so we have Hebrew in a semi-official use. So these are postcards basically issued in a kind of by the Ottoman Empire. And not only this, we have the cancellation mark that you can see on the stamp has Ottoman Turkish and French and Hebrew. You can see Yerushalem at the bottom of this. So this is a semi-official, you could say, use of Hebrew as a language that the Ottoman authorities are willing to kind of allow it to be used in that sense because it's a language of a large number of Jews in Jerusalem. And because Jews are very using post a lot during this period because they the Ashkenazi economy particularly depended on sending various various printed artifacts such as calendars and various other things and newspapers as a kind of product that they would export to various diaspora communities, and including requests for donations, but not just that, also actual products. And if we look at industry in Jerusalem among the Jewish communities, so we have about 6 print shops. So this is the main form of industry if you're looking for such. So in that sense, the postal connections are very important and they are a source of revenue. So when Hanig faces this postal office manager, faces accusation that he's a Zionist, that this is a form of, text that has various nationalist intentions, he justifies himself that this is a commercial initiative, and the idea is to appeal to Jewish communities in Jerusalem and so forth. And the Ottoman governor of the district defends this kind of rationale. It says, no, this is not about Zionism. This is about Hebrew as a kind of language for commercial use. So this is one example of kind of a use of Hebrew for commercial uses as a common denominator between different communities. Then we have the use of Hebrew as a Haskalah language by various diaspora organizations that come to Jerusalem as part of a project to modernize Jewish communities. And if in the dedication inscription I talk about networks of charity and donations, and these are networks that operated within these kind of ethnic economies, the Haskalah networks operated quite differently, in the sense that they saw Jewish communities in Jerusalem as backward and needing not only support, but needing modernization. And a part of a colonial mission, we could say, by French and German Jews to kind of reform and modernize Jewish communities in North Africa and the Levant, in the Balkans and so forth. And this is the Lemma School, the sign here by the Lemma School, the kind of the first modern Jewish school opened in the 1850s. And this is a new building that was opened around 1900s. You can see this is in the sign is in German and in Hebrew. And it was supported by the Ezra German Society, which was kind of competing with the Alliance French network. And the idea here is to recruit Jewish pupils of all communities, whether Sephardic or Ashkenazi and so forth, for a modern education that would kind of train them to become a middle class in the modernizing Ottoman Empire. Okay, so we have, so Hebrew here is a language of modernity, you could say, and of a kind of proto-national cultural imagination of a Jewish peoplehood that is not Zionist, but does see a kind of cultural common denominator that is not embedded within the older structures. Now, while these schools were not Zionist per se, they acted as incubators for Zionist teachers and pupils. And we know that the language war of 1913 about the role of Hebrew in instruction came out of the Ezra institutions like the Lemma School. And later it would become, the Lemma School would become one of those bastions of Hebrew nationalism. For example, the demonstrations before 1929 leave from the Lemma School. Okay, so this is one example of a kind of Hebrew is a proto-national language of modernity. Then we have Hebrew as a national language of Jewish communities, which is something that becomes stronger after 1908, and I'll say a few words yet. First of all, this is the mast of the Acharut newspaper. And one of the things we have in Jerusalem is a very vibrant landscape of Hebrew publishing. I mentioned the print shops already, but specifically newspapers. So there's a, depending when you look exactly, but there's about five Hebrew newspapers that are published in Jerusalem for various kind of perspectives, Orthodox, Hasidic modernizing, Chavatzelet. We have the kind of modernizing Litvak in Moriah newspaper. We have Eliezer ben Yehuda's Zionist secular newspapers, Haor. And we have this Harut, which was a modernizing Sephardic Zionist newspapers after 1908. It's important to say that all of them are in Hebrew and are all read by various political and ideological factions. And they create a kind of, again, the kind of imagined communities that that become, I would say, national at this point. Now, it's important to say that the 1908 revolution in the Ottoman Empire gives a huge boost to this. So after 1908, the constitutional revolution and the new elections for parliaments in 1908 and 1912, and that is creates an incentive for Jewish communities in Palestine specifically to coordinate and to start thinking of themselves as a national community. Now that happens in the context in which the Ottoman Empire is understood as an Ottoman meta-nation that is composed of different kind of nationalities. So you could be an Armenian national and an Ottoman national at the same time, Arab and Ottoman, and Jewish and Ottoman, and so forth. So when this kind of language of the Ottoman Empire as a family of nations emerges, there's a very strong incentive to Jewish communities and Jewish elites to think of themselves as a nation. And this is when we see the term Yishuv emerges really in a serious way. You know, people talk about the Yishuv, they project it backwards to the 19th century, but my argument, and I wrote about this in my article, Rethinking the Yishuv, my argument is that only after 1908, within that Ottoman context, there's these different communities see a room for them to think of themselves as one national group that is composed of different factions. The Zionists, and specifically what we know as labor Zionists, compose a very small and minor part in this story at this point. Okay, we have the voice of Sephardic Zionist Jews, like Acharut, is as dominant, if not more dominant, I would say, at this point. And they represent in many ways the elite of Jewish communities. And we have to remember that the leadership, at least in a formal way, the leadership of the Jewish community was in the hand of the Chacham Bashi, the chief rabbi of Palestine, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi. Okay? So nominally, the leader of this community, which is diverse, mixed, fragmented, and mostly non-Sephardic, is the Sephardic establishment. Now, it's clear by that time that this is that leadership is of limited value. but it's still nominally this is the this is a result. So the Sephardic elite remains as the kind of a very important element here. Now, Ahirut represents a line of Zionism that is, if we can say kind of very briefly, articulated in Hebrew, sees Hebrew as a national language, and is a primarily an urban form of nationalism that is focused around cultural revival and representation and cultural autonomy and representation within Ottoman structures. It is not focused on colonization. Okay, it is not against colonization per se, but it is not focused on colonization. And one example of that fact is that there's only one Sephardic colony out of this, by this time, about 15,000 Jews live in colonies in Palestine, in the agriculture colonies, the Moshavot, and they are a minority. There's about 80,000 Jews or so there are something like 20%. And mostly these are Ashkenazi Jews. There's only one Sephardic colony, which is Artov of Bulgarian Jews. Mostly we're talking about an urban milieu that is very much interested, and the elite is interested in cultural revival. And this is received, it's received, I would say, positively by the Ottoman elite. We can see this in the example of the fact that the Harut is the only newspaper that continues to operate during the war years after 1914, where all the other newspapers are gradually closed down by the censorship, whether in Arabic or in Hebrew. Harut is the only one that continues to operate until 1917. You can see here the date. The Ottomans also publish, they publish notices in Hebrew. They publish even a military newspapers in Hebrew. The Ottomans do not have any objection to the use of Hebrew generally. We do see that they are opposed to the use of Hebrew by various Zionist institutions, which they suspect are disloyal to the empire. But that's quite different from the use of Hebrew as a national language within the Ottoman Empire, which this is something that they certainly tolerate. Another example of use of Hebrew as a national language within Ottoman structure, and this is from the print shop strike, and this is from 1909, and you can see here the placards on the back says Yechiya Chofesh, long live liberty, and liberty means the constitutional revolution, the Young Turk revolution. Long live the a committee of print shop workers in Jerusalem, and you can see below that in Arabic as well. And the print shop strike was the first strike in the Jewish community in Jerusalem that brings together Sephardic and Ashkenazi workers with Zionist socialist agitators. You can see here on the left, it's Racheli Yanait Ben Tzvi, who would partner of Yitzhak Ben Tzvi and a socialist Zionist activist in herself. So here they very much try to fashion themselves as a loyal Ottoman subject, which kind of promote Hebrew as part of that context. But we all also have, so these are an example of Hebrew as an Ottoman national language, but we also have the kind of Hebrew which has a colonizing mission, which is associated with understanding Jewish nationalism as a colonial enterprise by its very meaning. And when I say colonial meaning, I'm saying that the colonization and transformation of Jews through that act of reconstituting what Jewishness means and what the land means is integral to that project. And we can see this in the Zionist socialist newspaper Hapoel HaTzair, which writes in 1913 in the context of the language war and the language war around the question of how much Hebrew will be used in Jewish modern institutions as language of instruction. Hapoel HaTzair writes, "Our world rests on three elements: Hebrew land, Hebrew labor, and Hebrew language." So land, labor, and language are the three realms which the young worker, these socialist Zionists, seek to take over, or in other words, to colonize. So the act of settlements, which at this point coalesces into, you know, there's conquest of labor and conquest of land by cooperative farms, comes together with the promotion and the conquest of the use of Hebrew as a dominant language. Now, what that means, it means two things. It means imposing Hebrew as an everyday language of use in signage, in commercial use, and so forth. But it also means the kind of language that makes a reference to the landscape and claims the kind of Zionist narratives of revival, rediscovery, reclaiming. Now, there's not many examples for that in Jerusalem in the late Ottoman period. One example we can say is the Bezalel School, the Bezalel Art School, which is a kind of bastion of secular Zionism at this point, which, of course, Bezalel makes a very explicit reference to the artist who built the temple. And that kind of connection to the biblical heritage will become very, very important, of course, in the kind of mythology of Zionism later. Now, that assumes, that changes quite dramatically in the kind of mandate 2 years. That kind of assumes different dimensions with the British mandate. And with British occupation, and especially in 1920, with the arrival of Herbert Samuel, Hebrew becomes a state language, an official language. And again, one of the first things that Herbert Samuel does is to print over the stamps that were used at this point the name of the country: Philistine in Arabic, Palestine in English, and Palestina, Eretz Israel in Hebrew. And Palestina, Eretz Israel, is this kind of compromise he comes up with quite quickly, because he's afraid of saying Eretz Israel, which is the Zionist term. So he is kind of has a kind of compromise to use the transliterated Palestina term. Now, that use immediately creates opposition from Arab nationalists. And I think it's very, very interesting that kind of that opposition emerges in this particular moment, because the use of Hebrew as a state language is not just about recognizing national cultural rights of a minority that lives in the country, but it's a recognition of the Balfour Declaration. It's a recognition of the mandate terms. It's a project which designates Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people, which comes with colonization, comes with some kind of threat of Jewish hegemony. And I think that's why we see our Arab opposition in 1920, where we don't really see it to the kind of Ottoman semi-official use of Hebrew that we saw before. And this means that Hebrew is present on signage in Jerusalem and in various kinds of artifacts. And that appearance of Hebrew is understood by Arab Palestinians as a way to claim space, as a threat to change the meaning of the country. And it's understood similarly by Zionist activists. What is interesting is that when you look at Zionist activists are very excited about recognition of Hebrew, but when Eliezer Ben Yehuda and David Yelin write to the mandatory authorities and say, yes, yes, we want more Hebrew, we want Hebrew to be in the telegraph, we want Hebrew to be used on train tickets, we want Hebrew on every sign, their rationale is not we want to take over land so much, as their biggest fear is that there's lots of Jews coming from lots of countries, and if we don't indoctrinate them to use Hebrew, they will all revert to their language of use, their everyday languages. So that's part of the idea, is colonization, not so much of the land at this point, but colonization of the Jewish communities, and this kind of awareness that the Hebrew revival at this point is a very fragile and vulnerable enterprise. Hebrew in its kind of secular national use is still something that is among a young generation graduates of some kind of schools, but it's something that could be easily overturned by a mass use of Hebrew, of Yiddish and other languages. So that's the primary reason they are interested in. But the more time goes by, the more we see the signage becomes one of the battlegrounds for Zionist activists. And we see it particularly in street names that that Zionist bodies very much push neighborhoods to introduce sign name plates in Hebrew. This is part of the idea of kind of territorializing the language and claiming the territory through signage. And partly it's about indoctrination, the kind of names that you choose, of course. And these are ideally names that will resonate with the kind of Jewish history that Zionist official bodies want to cultivate at this point. But it's also about making Hebrew visible in the urban landscape and kind of laying claim to the territory. It's very striking that we don't see it in among the Arab elite. So Arab elite is not particularly bothered about street naming, and it's not a very high priority. But when there is a new name in Arabic for some street, there's immediately a commotion in the Hebrew Zionist press and a sense of threat to the kind of Jewish character of Jerusalem and so forth. So there's a very strong emphasis on territorializing the language, which again is part of the idea of the language of Yitiyashvut, of settling, of taking over both Jewish communities and making them into one whole, and taking over territory, which is something that becomes, of course, much more pronounced after 1948, with issues of names for geography, for street names, for neighborhoods, and so forth. And I can say more on that. So to conclude, I think we start by seeing Hebrew widely used as a congregational language that is embedded within diasporic networks of piety and support and charity. We move to a language that is a kind of commercial common denominator, and then a national, proto-national language in Ottoman context, and then to a national language with a colonizing zeal. And these suggest different kind of registers and different kind of, I would say, resources that we can work with, and in trying to think And I think when we try to think what would Jewish nationalism that is not Zionism, or at least not Zionism in the way that we understand it today, as an ideology that is driven towards territory and takeover, what would it mean? I think we can see here various kind of resources that we can work with. And I'll end here. Unmute yourself. I can't.
Peter, you are muted.
Hold on. Yes, is that better? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, now you hear me okay? Good, sorry about that. I couldn't get the taskbar to come up when the presentation was still on online, so excuse my technological incapabilities. And by the way, I forgot to thank Yaakov for sorting out all the technological stuff before we began this. Yair, thank you very much. I would kind of urge anyone who has a question to please now type it into the live event Q&A. We have none at the moment, but if I may, a couple of maybe comments or questions for you, Yair, if that's okay, while we're waiting for other people to load up. I suppose you talk about this kind of standardization of Hebrew in one way. This is actually not all that different from a standardization, let's say, of Italian and Germany as a kind of nationalist necessity, perhaps, I don't know, or certainly a pursuit. But I suppose there was a different dimension here, whereas in Italy and Germany, you're trying to kind of standardize a language that was existing in situ already for many hundreds of years, and we're just kind of the standardization of dialects. And here we're talking something completely different. And it's probably maybe restating the obvious a little bit, but to what extent do you think this is just, indicative or another example of this kind of trend in kind of a certain type of nationalist direction? And how much do you think it is particular to Zionist, the Zionist situation or the situation of Jews in Palestine?
I mean, I think there's some really important differences there. And the first is the sanctity of the language, yeah, which is underlying, I think. And I focus when in the book to discuss this transformation. I used Agnon's Only Yesterday, Tmol Shilshom, and I assume some people listening will be familiar that it's a story of a Jewish immigrant, Aliyah Shnia, second Aliyah, that comes to Palestine to be a pioneer, and he doesn't quite work out, and he goes to Jerusalem and he becomes a painter. And the pivotal scene in the book is when he's bitten by a stray dog. When he encounters a stray dog. Now, how does this scene start? He's painting a dedication inscription in the Bukharan quarter. The kind of exactly one of those dedication inscriptions that I showed. He is hired to paint the inscription in different colors. And part of the idea you paint the name of the donor in gold, you paint the warning in black, you paint the others in red. So that's partly to show that this kind of inscription does not end when you put the stone there. It's a continuous practice, and it's a practice that hinges on Hebrew being a sacred language, that Hebrew has a power, that when you warn people against it, you know, you should not never sell the building. You warn, the warning is in Hebrew, it carries some kind of divine weight behind it. Mm-hmm. And he starts by painting this, and then there's a dog walking by, and he writes on the dog, Kelev Meshuga, mad dog.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, I think, and there's been enormous, many people wrote about it, but I think Agnon says, you know, trying to say something about, you know, it's a kind of rupture and moment of crisis where you take the same colors that you use for a dedication inscription, in which Hebrew means something quite, you know, quite specific, and use it as a kind of joke to mark a dog and to label it, you know. And the dog, of course, then roams the street of Jerusalem. So the language becomes activated, and the language is sent to the street of Jerusalem, and becomes something that kind of travels through space in a much less controlled manner, in a way that comes to bite Isaac in the end. And I think that kind of bedrock of Hebrew square letters and their meaning is something that we won't find in Italian, but we will find it in Arabic to some extent, in the Islamic meaning of Arabic. So Arabic as a language of, you know, as a divine language that carries us, then we do have, and its transformation to a national language, that is a parallel that we see in Arabic. And also in Arabic, we do, the other thing that we do have in Hebrew and does not exist in the Italian or German example is the transformation to a spoken language. But I would say that this is something sometimes misunderstood and overstated, because the fact is, for the Haredi Litvak publishers of Moria, it's obvious for them that they write in Hebrew.
Yeah.
And this is 1912. They don't need Eliezer Ben Yehuda to tell them to write in Hebrew about news, about science, about Ottoman politics. So Hebrew is very much, you know, activated and live as a cultural political language that is used for various kinds of coalitions and, you know, that change and transform. So the idea that Hebrew is a kind of language, as an active modern language, is something that belongs only to this very small Zionist secular enclaves, I think that is misleading, and that is something that we see. And the reason that they choose Hebrew is because there is such diversity in the Jewish community, and because they write, you know, they want people to buy their newspapers not just in Palestine but also in Eastern Europe, yeah, or maybe in Baghdad or in other places. That kind of creates a kind of common denominator, which is also beyond the national line in that sense. Or the national geography.
So I would say also the irony is, of course, that the big argumentation between the first real Zionist school, the Herzliya Gymnasium, was around whether they around this very time was whether they should teach in German or Hebrew, and it was not a very it was completely not very clear, actually, and that's why there was a strike. So it's actually very interesting. Jakob, I don't see any questions. So is that the case that I'm doing something wrong, or is it there are no questions? No, oh, Jakob's muted. Okay, oh, you're muted, Jakob. Hold on.
Yes, thank you. There are no questions, so I'll take the
sure.
I guess the producer prerogative to
please
ask a couple of questions. Yair, first of all, thank you so much for this fascinating talk and interesting book. I want to make a couple of comments that you already touched upon, but maybe to trigger you to speak about them a little bit in more detail, and then maybe also a question. So the two comments I have is that it's one comment about your intervention, whether, you know, explicitly or implicitly so, in two very interesting debates. One, as you just noted, is this question of the revival of Hebrew, or I guess I can say, building on you, the myth of the revival of Hebrew, myth in the negative sense of it, that a myth that tells us a story about a dead language that is then being revived. I think part of this has to do with a more general question, which is about Jewish nationalism. And again, the debate here rages from all over the place, but you, in a sense, offer an intervention into this debate of whether there was a sense of Jewish nationhood prior to Zionism. And I think there's room for developing this idea, and which has been done previously, that this usage of Hebrew as a common denominator of different communities within the self-perceived Jewish community can be a marker of this, a sense of peoplehood. Maybe not modern European nationalism, but definitely a sense of nationhood. And this brings me to the question, a large section of this era that you covered is an era where Hebrew is just one language among a multilingual setting where these same people, call them Jews, call them Sephardim, Ashkenazim, speak. I mean, and your forthcoming project is about Arab Ashkenazis or Ashkenazi Arabs, so people who speak Arabic as their language, would probably at least among the elite, also Hebrew as a spoken language. And we can assume that under Ottoman rule, French is very present. Ladino could also be. And the story you're telling is also a story of the death of multilingualism under the heavy hammer of nationalism. And this move toward it's not just the nationalization of the language, it's also the weaponization of language in the nationalist cause, where multilingualism becomes a threat. And then, an ideological force is trying to erase it. So the question would be, I guess to frame it as a question, all of those inscriptions, for example, which are written in Hebrew, are written in Hebrew as a choice, as you just say, because there are other languages that could be maybe even more accessible, maybe better understood. Can you say something about the way those people, your agents in a sense, lived among these different languages and how it disappears from the scene?
That's clearly the direction from multilingualism to monolingualism. I think there's various anecdotal examples that I can think. For example, I would say first we have to think in multi-scalar terms. When we think about this period, it would be wrong to tell it, people behaved differently depending to the network that they were talking with at that moment. And they presented themselves differently according to who they were talking with. And there was no, there's a book by Johan Bussov called Hamidian Palestine. And one of the nice thing he has maps of where people were born according to the census. So you can see that you have Ashkenazi communities, there's, clearly connection to Eastern and Central Europe. Sephardic are kind of regional, more or less. Arab Muslims are very local, Arab Christian. So you have different kind of networks that had various kinds of interactions. To give one example, so the Fomkin family. So the Fomkin Hasidic Lubavitchers have a print shop and have a newspaper. And the big conflict between the father and the sons is around Arabic. The father is speaks Arabic, very much integrated into local politics and so forth, even hires someone to teach Arabic to his kids. But he's unhappy when one of the kids, again, Ashkenazim, okay? One of them goes to Jaffa to be an Arabic teacher in a Hebrew school. And he's unhappy about that. And the other one, Gad, writes an editorial in the newspaper saying, Jews, you should start learning Arabic. And the father, you know, deletes these lines, and there's a big confrontation between them. And for them, Arabic was the language of modernity, integration, progress, and clearly about becoming Ottoman in a way that moved beyond what the father was comfortable with. Although the father was very much, you know, you can, Israel Dorfumkin, you can find the pictures with him with a fez. Yeah, he's very integrated, but there are the limits. Now, of course, Gadfumkin later becomes a judge. Part of his social capital is the fact he's fluent in Arabic in the court. But that becomes ultimately a liability, I would say. So in the sense that he's pleased to the Zionist Yishuv leader, you know, we must learn Arabic and so forth, etc. All this goes on deaf ears, and eventually that kind of what is a value at this at a certain point becomes a liability in the other. I would say that Leora Halperin's book, Babel and Zion, is a good book on the kind of enduring multilingualism in the Yishuv. Of course, people continue to speak Yiddish or other languages, on Arabic or other languages that they brought with them, but they were facing more and more pressure to stop doing this. For example, by the battalion of the defenders of the Hebrew language, which were quite aggressive in telling people off to remove signs in other languages. And for them, again, the whole language that they use is the language of settlement, of colonization, of, you know, for them, Hebrew is a language of building, you know, something in the wilderness. And again, it's a very, very settler colonial language. That's what's different from the language of David Yelin, for example. For him, Hebrew kind of exists in parallel with other kind of, and in conversation, again, depending what moment you catch him, but for him, it's more of a conversation with other languages.
So we had two questions come up. Hold on, let me just go back. There we go. Okay. Oh, yeah. So first, should I just read them out, Jacob? Yeah. So the first is from my colleague Rose Stair, who's doing a DPhil in here at Oxford. And she said, I'm wondering about public spaces where the different uses of Hebrew that you outline might clash with or comment upon one another. Do you see conversations between these different uses of Hebrew opening up in graffiti and vandalism, etc.?
Not so much in that sense. What you do see is Zionist unhappiness about the Jewish communities in Jerusalem and their willingness to embrace the new kind of ideas that they were pushing. And I think that's very, very striking. For example, around street names, and there's two stories in the Var from the late 30s that I'm quoting in the book. There was a map of Jerusalem that came out with street names. And these names were not necessarily official. A lot of them were just people posting in or local neighborhood committee deciding on names. They didn't ask anyone in the municipality, and they just put a sign. Okay, now most of these tended to rely or fall back on commemoration practices in the Jewish community. So a lot of them were various rabbinical figures in Rabbi Sonnenfeld and others that were part of these communities. And the Var is very, very unhappy about street names in Jerusalem in Hebrew. They say it's a disgrace. Where are, you know, the heroes of the nation? Why do we have all these rabbis? Nobody knows these rabbis. Nobody cares about these rabbis. You know, what about some good Zionist education through street names, which you do see in Tel Aviv? I think Tel Aviv, one of the early things that you can see is, you know, for example, by the characters that they, the names that are chosen, for example, Herzl or other Zionist activists, whether it's the biblical geography of the landscape, which are used as street names and so forth. So that kind of the idea of Jews in Jerusalem not living up to the Zionist expectations is quite a strong one. That I mean, you can see it in the fact that Jerusalem continued to pose a problem for the Zionist leadership, which mostly lived out, not in Jerusalem. I mean, I think I'm quoting Ben-Gurion in 48 that says that there's 20% normal people and then 40% reactionaries or 60% reactionaries and 40% strange people and 20% normal university related and so forth. So the idea of Jerusalem as a hostile environment to is something that I think Zionist institutions struggled with, and you can see it. I mean, what you see in street names is in Rehavia, for example, is a very deliberate choice to use Sephardic to go back to the Golden Age, and El Harizi, Alfasi, Ben Maimon, and all these names are a very explicit kind of overture of the founders of the neighborhood, which was Sephardic elite, and also a kind of conviviality, I think, that they thought would be useful for any kind of relations with the Arab Muslim and elite. And I think that is very clear, and it's very, very striking that the Sephardic names, you find them in Arabic as well, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. But the name I showed, Keren Kayemet Yisrael, which is also part of the neighborhood, it's about the JNF, the Jewish National Front, has only English and Hebrew, and does not, and that was put in a later stage where there's no attempt even to kind of to talk in Arabic.
Thanks, Yair. So I have another question, sorry to pull my glasses first, for someone from Thiel Mingledorf, who says, thank you for your very interesting lecture, Dr. Wallach. You mentioned that Hebrew ultimately developed as a commercial common denominator, and based on the late Ottoman mandatory period artifacts you uncovered, did this new use of Hebrew extend beyond the diaspora communities in Israel, for example, to transnational Jewish trade flowing in and out of Jerusalem at this time?
I mean, it's, yes, certainly I would say that that Hebrew is used as something that cuts across communities, and you, if you want to advertise, for example, cinema, okay? Cinema is local. So when we find adverts for Cinema Tzion, so they're mostly in Hebrew. There will be the title of the movie would be in Arabic, because maybe you get some, you know, Arab clientele as well, and that is something that appeals to, you know, cuts across communities. But often it's more difficult to make these clear cut distinctions, because when you put a big sign in Hebrew, then why do you put the sign, you know, above your shop? I think if it's, you know, people know it's not a, such a big place, you don't need a sign. If you're a barber, everybody will know where you are. I mean, there's no big, so partly it's about kind of, you know, saying, oh, I have a sign. I'm part of the new world, which uses signs, okay? Yeah. And partly it's about tourists. And partly it's a way to advertise yourself. So we've seen in the Bezalel sign. I mean, the sign was not there, so if somebody doesn't know the way, they can find a way to Bezalel's school. the sign is there for the photograph, and the photograph is there in order for fundraising. But also the sign does say something to the new, to the people involved. I brought the Lemel School and the sign in Hebrew and German. And part of the sign is saying that we are not a Talmud Torah. You know, we're a different kind of institution. We're a modern institution. We are, you know, and I bring in the book the short story by Ezraham Nachem. Ezraham Nachem is a novelist and short story writer, Sephardic Jew from Macedonia, who immigrated to Jerusalem when he was six in the beginning of the century. And he has a story about how he goes. He leaves the Talmud Torah, his Sephardic Talmud Torah, and he decides to join Lemel because it's a new modern thing. And the sign is very important. You can see the sign is part of that kind of promise of the tomorrow. For him, it's a very, and the story shows also the ambivalence of Jews going through that transformation, because it's a story of disappointment. He regrets making that transition. He regrets living that kind of warm world of the Talmud Torah. And, you know, for him, Lemel is a cold, alienated place, smells of disinfectant. It doesn't have, you know, it's a disciplinary institution, which he feels very, very foreign, and partly it's a partly it's an ethnic thing, because it's a very, you know, it's a very Ashkenazi in a modern sense, not in a, it's led by European Jews that have a colonizing mission that he feels alienated in. So that is both the kind of promise, the signage are about the kind of transformation that are, I would say, both projected outwards to a diaspora networks. And I think every Jew in Jerusalem is aware of diaspora, some kind of diaspora networks, whether it's the networks of charity, or whether it's the Alliance, or the Ezra, or whether it's the Zionists, that they have some kind of influence of their lives, and their position within their networks is quite crucial. And in that sense, I think that when I talk about the emergence of a proto-national identity, and this is very much in response to diaspora Jewish institutions who wanted to overcome these kind of congregational divides and talk about in one Jewish peoplehood, if you want. And I think that is something that helps to create this kind of common denominator.
So thank you very much. Jacob, if you've not got another question, maybe I'll just end with a final question to you.
I think there's a question from Danielle.
And I'm sorry. Yeah, Yeah, I've got to screw up. So Danielle's here too, Drori, who says, thank you for an interesting talk. While I see how monolingualism becomes the dominant paradigm in the Jewish parts of Jerusalem once Hebrew undergoes Zionification, it seems like multilingualism persists. So would you say your work is as much about the failure of Hebrew's nationalization as it is about its success?
I don't know if, I mean, multilingualism survives to the mandatory years, but much less so afterwards. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at in the work by Jonathan Mandel on Arabic was eradicated, and I think it's quite striking how very few people, how very few Israeli Jews can read Arabic, let alone write in Arabic today. given, and when you look a century backwards, some of these are Arabic-speaking communities, some of these communities that can negotiate their way in Arabic. And that is very much, that is something that was very aggressively eradicated. And partly, I think we are also living in a world which does not reward multilingualism. It's not just the case of Palestine, Israel, and Zionism. I mean, we can see this in with immigrant children everywhere. And I'm always struck by, you know, today to get your kids, if you come from come with a language, and you live in London or in the US and so forth, and you want to make sure your kids speak the language, it's such a struggle. And I think, you know, Sephardic Jews kept Ladino 400 years. Mm. You know, we can barely keep the languages one generation forward. It is quite extraordinary. So in that sense, it's not completely unique. It's part of a world which rewards monolingualism and kind of, in some ways, does not reward multilingualism. But in Israel-Palestine, it does connect to specifically to the question of Arabic as a rival enemy language and part of that kind of territorialization and struggle over space and meaning.
Good, thanks, Yair. So I just maybe, I thought I'd just, by way of concluding, ask you some perhaps to talk a little bit about the book and the project itself. I mean, it's very clear from the introduction that there's a personal dimension to all this, which I found really kind of touching, touching in a way, and very interesting. And kind of, I thought it was also quite interesting, you know, a book that's called A City in Fragments has chapter titles that are very fragmentary themselves. I thought it was quite a touch of genius. But I just wondered if you could just maybe talk a little bit about the project and the book.
I think the idea, I mean, there's different ways I can tell the story of the book, but the idea came primarily from an interest in textuality. I mean, I think that's where I started. As my sense is that that the 20th century forms of textuality that we grew up on are losing their place in the world. And digital textuality that we are being bombarded with is a new form, kind of suggests new forms of reading and writing. So in a way, I wanted to understand how the kind of things that we grew up with as standard forms of text that kind of organize our lives, how did they come to be? Street nameplate, you know, since when people put street nameplates in the street and why? You know, shop signs, commercial use of text, text that kind of bans and tells you what to do and not to do. At one point, graffiti becomes something that you cannot do, that is forbidden, that is banned. You know, this visiting cards that we still carry around us, but it's not clear why. Everybody can Google you. You don't need to give them your card. We still have them. So at what point did they emerge and why? But it became very clear that to understand these kinds of forms of textuality, I need to go a step backwards to look at when they emerge and against what background they emerge. So in that sense, Jerusalem was perfect because I start the book in 1850s, it's not like there's no text in the street. There's lots of text in the street. It's just different kinds of text and its meaning is different. So, and it's the kind of text that nobody is nostalgic about. I mean, there's dedication inscription. I think for most people who view them, you know, if we see a nice 1920s street nameplate, it evokes some kind of nostalgia that I think for most secular people, the dedication inscription does not carry the same kind of nostalgia. But I think you can't understand one without the other. I think you have to understand, especially when you talk about Hebrew and Arabic. It was important for me to do a project that looked at two non-European languages. And that's since Jerusalem is very, very important as a place that is very rich in textual traditions, but also a place where everything collides. So you have Ottomanism, you have European empires, you have Christian missionaries, you have various kinds of Jewish communities that we talked about, you have Arab nationalists, and so forth. Now, for me personally, I think what the book was interesting was also the way to see Jerusalem in a fresh new eyes. And that's because the question for me was not how I, in 2020, I look at a sign and I analyze it. I will tell you what it means. No, the question for me is what, when people put a sign in 1910, what does it mean to people in the street? And that's a much more difficult question. And for that, I had to read quite a lot of memoirs and autobiographies and newspapers and so forth. And from that, I actually came to see the city quite differently than I am used to it. I mean, I have an essay that came out on the Jerusalem city center, but the idea of Jerusalem as a kind of modernizing Ottoman city around the turn of the century that has a non-sectarian understanding of a local middle class, an Ottoman middle class that is very much kind of open to cosmopolitan influences. That was something of a revelation for me. And in a way, seeing the late Ottoman city, which is not the Jerusalem that I grew up in, or I was not even aware that such a city existed. That was quite a new revelation, and in a way kind of made me, when I walk through the cities, I have this kind of companions and friends that walk with me and tell me different stories. And partly it was about going in the street and looking for signs, signs on the sewage, on various kind of street names that nobody pays attention to, or old signs and so forth, and trying to read the city through these signs. So this is the kind of the project.
Right. Thanks, Yair. So I think that's we've got to conclude now. I just wanted to say that so next week, we continue with the Israel Studies seminar, and we'll have our colleague Hadil Abu Hussein, who will talk about Palestinian Arab cities and Israel equality struggle. And in 2 weeks from today, we'll have Danielle Drori, who just posed the last question, the final question to Yair. Danielle is teaching modern Hebrew literature here at Oxford this year, and she'll do the reconsidering early Jewish nationalist ideology seminar on Josef Klausner and translation, Zionism and Christianity. So, if you can come both of those, please do. And I would just encourage you one more time to have a look at Jerusalem, a city in fragments. Yair Volok, thank you very, very much for helping out today and speaking to us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.